Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, coming to you live from London. Well, we start today with a shock election result in Romania. A brand new presidential candidate, Călin Georgescu, has upended Romania's political scene by scoring the highest tally of votes in the first round of the Eastern European country's presidential election. To many, Mr. Georgescu appears to have come out of nowhere. He doesn't have the backing of a political party, and he doesn't appear to have a solid platform. What he does have is a strong following on social media. Known by some as the TikTok candidate, the 62-year-old launched a hugely popular social media campaign days before the vote, calling for an end to aid for Ukraine. Since winning the first round of the vote, he's said the result is an amazing awakening for the Romanian people. He'll face the centre-right candidate, Elena Lasconi, in a runoff election next month. Prime Minister Marcel Ciolacu failed to make the second round. He's already resigned as leader of his Social Democratic Party. The former Romanian Prime Minister Victor Ponta, who's also from the SDP, said the result was completely unexpected and would have a negative impact on Romania.
It's a big shock. It's first time that traditional parties are almost crushed in the presidential election. It is a big reverse of the predictability of Romania. And the next 2 weeks, taking into account that we will have also parliamentary election and second round of presidential, will give a lot of unpredictability. And that's a big setback for Romania.
Adrian Asina is a member of the European Parliament from the far-right nationalist party, the Alliance for the Unification of Romanians, or AUR. He said Călin Georgescu had tapped into the concerns of many Romanians.
Georgescu, I think he's fighting for sovereignty and traditionalism. His campaign emphasized with national independence, the protection of Romanian values, and reducing reliance on European institutions. His message resonates with a segment of the population that feels globalization and the European reforms have sidelined national interests.
Now let's speak to Andreea Georgescu. She's a journalist with the Digi24 TV station in Bucharest and joins us live. Andreea, tell us more about the winner of this vote, Călin Georgescu. We should note that you have the same last name, but you're not related.
Yes, so we have the same last name, but we are definitely not related. Georgescu is actually quite a familiar last name, quite common. Last name here in Romania, but we are not all relatives, of course. Călin Georgescu is known as a low-profile politician, an extremely religious and nationalistic political character. He's also known for being Moscow-friendly, as we say here in Bucharest. He once spoke in an interview about Vladimir Putin as being, and I quote, a man who loves his country, and he militates during the last few months on leaving Ukraine, a deal on its own in the war against Russia. He also talks frequently about NATO and the European Union not representing correctly Romanian interests of our citizens.
Mm. And what's the reaction to this result?
The result came as a shock, especially among traditional mainstream media, because Călin Georgescu was not a character quite known to people who take their information through mainstream media, online, TV, radio, and so on. But he is quite popular, extremely popular, especially during the last 2 or 3 weeks online. Through TikTok, he has millions of followers there. Actually, in Romania, there are almost 10 million accounts on this platform, on TikTok platform, and there are a lot of people who share his messages, who seem to accept his messages and take them forward through TikTok, and he is quite an online star, we can say. Actually, besides the first few words, his first declaration after he was we saw the first estimates for the votes were for traditional media, but this evening he has announced a meeting with his followers online via TikTok, via YouTube, via social media platforms, actually.
Okay, lots more to come. Andrea Georgescu, thank you for speaking to us. Andrea is a journalist with the Digi24 TV station in Bucharest. So let's hear more on how the political newcomer, Călin Georgescu, managed to surprise Romania's political establishment with this win. Radu Magdin is a political analyst based in Bucharest. He's the honorary advisor to the Romanian Prime Minister in 2015. Radu, we've heard the thoughts from the journalist Andrea Georgescu, but how do you think Călin Georgescu pulled off this election victory?
There's a combination of factors. And first of all, hello, and thank you so much for inviting me. So the first factor which actually led to a major boost, tactically speaking, is the fact that another ultra-conservative candidate, Misty Shoshoka, she was ousted from the presidential arena around a month ago. So there was time for this part of the electorate who didn't like the other ultra-conservative, Mr. Simeon from AUR, to search for an alternative. So part of the votes can be explained by this donation, if we can call it like this, of votes from Mrs. Shoshoka and her party SOS towards Mr. Georgescu. This was amounted by a pollster somewhere between 8% and 12% of the electorate. Separate from that, Florin Georgescu is somebody, sorry, that's my daughter.
That's all right, that's all right.
It's like in that TV commercial. So separate from that, Călin Georgescu is somebody who has been knocking at the doors of Romanian politics with frustrations for quite some time right now. He periodically liked to see his name touted on sources as possible PM proposal, but this never really materialized
Some are pointing a finger at Russia. They say Russia might have had a hand in this. Do you agree with that?
There's a saying which there's a proverb which says the following: just because you're paranoid, it doesn't mean that you're not followed by them. So from this perspective, one could point towards Russia, but it's not for me as an analyst to say that. I think an inquiry by relevant intelligence services who are monitoring our information space is much more useful. And let's see if and what vulnerabilities they will mention in the following days, because if indeed we were penetrated, and I would hesitate for the moment to say that, then we do have a problem, including for parliamentary elections next Sunday. Now, perhaps there was some online acceleration in an environment in which the others, they weren't that present, because the reality is the majority of Romanian political class has preferred to campaign either via mainstream media or maximum via Instagram. Very few of them, they were really on TikTok. There were some tries and some videos, but there was not like consistent TikTok activity in Romania. So we could say that the political class has discovered TikTok. The political class has discovered emotions management. Uh-huh. And this has for sure contributed to the result.
Radu, just briefly, are there any indications the other parties will pull together to try to change the outcome of the runoff election?
There are likely to be a lot of negotiations because there is an element of shock across parties. The question is, at least for the main two historic parties, which were part of the Grand Party Coalition and still are theoretically in parliament, the two largest party, who will do that negotiation? Because the two leaders are de facto ousted today, the latest tomorrow, and there will be ad interim players who will try eventually to
negotiate.
I'm
so sorry, Radu Magdin. We're going to have to leave it there. Radu Magdin is a political analyst based in Bucharest. Moving to a different part of the former Soviet Union, Georgia's parliament has convened for the first time since last month's disputed election. Large crowds of opposition protesters have gathered outside the parliament building. Demonstrators in Tbilisi, many of whom spent the night camped on the streets, say the victory of the Georgian Dream Party was fraudulent. Well, our correspondent Rayan Dimitri joins us now from Tbilisi. Rayan, what's the latest?
Well, the latest is that there are just a few hundred protesters that are still here outside parliament. I can see that the tents are being taken down. And this is quite, I would say, a grim end to what started last night. There was a 24-hour protest. Some people camped out here outside parliament. They were trying to prevent MPs from the ruling party, Georgian Dream, from holding their first session. But despite the big protest, despite the country's president declaring that this was unconstitutional, because according to the constitution, the president has to open the session after the elections, she has refused to do so. So despite all of this, the parliament went ahead and the credentials were handed down to the MPs from the governing Georgian Dream Party. So only they were present in parliament today, because the opposition is boycotting the parliament and they have refused to take up their seats. Well, I think, Celia, the next question is, like, for Georgians, what's next? I've been talking to some of the protesters here. Yes, the weather is not on their side. It's cold, it's wet. But those who are still here in the streets, mainly young people, they just look lost and directionless. And they've been protesting for months, back in the spring and again now after the elections, challenging the results. There's no opposition, no one to hear to tell them what's going to happen next.
Rayan, how much evidence is there that the victory of the Georgia Dream Party was fraudulent?
Well, according to many reports by local observer groups, by civil society organizations, there's mass-scale violations. And the president of this country also agrees with those findings. She has filed a lawsuit in the Constitutional Court trying to challenge the legitimacy of the vote. So they're saying, and we've seen a lot of evidence, they're talking about voter secrecy not being guaranteed, ballot papers were transparent enough, and it was seen who the voter voted for. But all of this criticism, it was all rejected by the Georgian Dream Party.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rayan. That was the BBC's Rayan Dimitri speaking to us from Tbilisi, from the site of those protests in Georgia's, outside Georgia's parliament building. Stay with us on NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour. A BBC Africa Eye investigation has exposed a fertility scam fueling a black market trade in babies in Nigeria. Women, desperate to be mothers, pay hundreds of dollars for drugs they're told will guarantee they'll conceive. They're duped into believing they're pregnant, in some cases for up to 2 years. Meanwhile, a baby is bought and sold in preparation for a fake birth. The BBC's Yemisi Adegoke reports.
That's the sound of government officials raiding a building near Umunya, a town in Anambra, southeastern Nigeria. It's mobile phone footage from the state's Ministry of Health.
We saw six young girls.
Women with pregnant bellies stare blankly at the camera.
How many pregnant women lose here?
It looks like an average health clinic, but it's a place where cryptic pregnancy scammers get their babies.
Are you pregnant?
Cryptic pregnancy is a medical term. It's when a woman is unaware she's pregnant until late in the pregnancy. It's a rare phenomenon. But here, it refers to something completely different. A miracle fertility treatment. It's big business. And it's a scam. The women are taken to a nearby hospital. One of them agreed to speak to us if we didn't use her real name and changed her voice.
They said that after delivery, they will give me money. How much money did they say they were giving?
800,000.
800,000 naira.
She looks scared and confused. In her arms is a baby girl.
Now looking back, do you regret that decision?
I am still confused.
You're still confused. It's okay. Okay.
Abortion is a criminal offence in Nigeria. Women faced up to 7 years in prison. It's only permitted if the mother's life is in danger.
Some of these girls wouldn't want their parents to know. Then after giving birth, they will be given money.
Ifi Obianabo is Anambra State's Commissioner for Women's Affairs.
Crypto pregnancy cannot exist without child trafficking. Anybody that tells you you will have a child through crypto pregnancy is a liar. You are going to be giving another person's child, a trafficked child.
My colleagues from the BBC in Lagos, Chiagozie and Abere, find another so-called cryptic pregnancy clinic. This one is also in Anambra. A secret camera shows dozens of women waiting inside a small hotel. Cheers of joy come from the consultation room. Someone has been told she's pregnant. They meet a woman who calls herself Dr. Ruth. For $200, she hands over a bag of unlabeled drugs, which she says will guarantee Ebere gets pregnant.
Okay.
When Ebere returns 4 weeks later, the miracle happens. She claims Ebere is pregnant, but it's a lie. Ebere did a pregnancy test at the hospital. It was negative.
It's not like normal pregnancy.
Dr. Ruth explains the baby can't be delivered until she's given another drug. This one costs around $1,000. We've heard numerous reports of how women do actually believe they've given birth. Some say they're given drugs and told to push. Others talk of waking up with a cesarean-like incision.
Miraculous pregnancy. I'm telling you with my experience.
Back at the commissioner's office in Anambra, a baby is at the centre of an extraordinary exchange.
I'm the one that carried it. Nobody carried it for me. Tell you what I passed through as a woman.
This woman got her baby through the cryptic pregnancy clinic that was raided in February.
Have you shown any kind of DNA test?
They said it's negative. It will take time.
And you believe this cock and bull story? Are you not educated? All this story is a scam.
Throughout all of this, I couldn't take my eyes away from the tiny baby.
I'm a beetle. I don't know what the man is doing there. I went to hospital like others went to hospital.
The commissioner makes the couple agree if the biological parents come forward to claim the child, they would have to give him up.
I don't know, maybe it's just me, but like I still felt like empathy towards these parents. They believe that they went through this process and this is their child.
There are still many women, knowingly or not, falling for the cryptic pregnancy scam in Nigeria, fueling an underground trade in babies. The BBC asked Dr. Ruth to respond to the allegations made in this investigation, but did not receive any response.
Yemisi Adegoke, reporting from Nigeria. Now, one of Britain's most successful authors, Barbara Taylor Bradford, has died. She was 91. A prolific writer, Taylor Bradford's debut novel, A Woman of Substance, sold more than 30 million copies. She wrote a total of 40 novels during her career, all of which became worldwide bestsellers. And she was well aware of the challenges involved in writing something believable, saying once, "A novel is a monumental lie that has to have the absolute ring of truth if it's going to succeed." She told the BBC why she thought A Woman of Substance was so popular.
People came to me at book signings or they wrote to me, and it was always the same thing. She is my role model. Every woman said that. If she could do it, starting with nothing, I can.
Earlier, I spoke to her biographer, Piers Dudgeon, about Barbara Taylor Bradford's life.
Well, Barbara was a woman of her time. The first novel, A Woman of Substance, is really, in many ways, Barbara's own story. It is set in Edwardian times. It tells the story of an impoverished domestic servant called Emma Hart, who falls for the son of an aristocrat for whom she works, is made pregnant by him, is then deserted by him, and she is empowered by really fury and a determination for revenge. The novel came out in 1979. It was the time of Margaret Thatcher. And Barbara liked to tell of the occasion these two women of substance met at a reception at Number 10. Can I tell you the story?
Sure.
Barbara had noticed a picture of Winston Churchill in the hall outside the reception room and had slipped out to look more closely at it. Mrs. Thatcher followed her out and asked if she was all right. Barbara said, "I never thought a girl from Yorkshire like me would be standing here looking at a portrait of Winston Churchill inside 10 Downing Street at the invitation of the Prime Minister." Mrs. Thatcher whispered, Barbara told me, "I know what you mean." This was the time with Mrs. Thatcher when she came to power, when a lot of women felt that it was their moment.
And is that a theme that went through many of Barbara Taylor Bradford's books?
All of them. All the novels encourage women to believe they can conquer the world, whatever their class or background, and despite the fact that then they were operating in a man's world much more than today. That's their energy. Their energy is it's the author's own energy. And that's the reason she sells all these copies.
She wrote 40 worldwide bestsellers. What was her process? How did she carry out her work? Was she somebody who sat down at a desk for a certain number of hours a day?
Oh, yes, most definitely. I mean, her background was, okay, this fairly poor background. Her mother was a domestic servant. Her father was an unemployed labourer. She lived like Emma Hart. She was just very, very gutsy. She took advantage of these new opportunities for women in the post-war era. But, you asked me how she sat down to write. She would be rigorous. She would work every day and for a certain number of hours, 4 or 5 hours a day at it. By the time I met her, she lived in a sixth-floor apartment in New York. It was quite extraordinary. I'd been doing research in Yorkshire for the book, and suddenly I was transported the few decades that had separated her from that landscape into this, really, the land of the super rich.
Piers Dudgeon, the biographer of the best-selling author Barbara Taylor Bradford, who's died aged 91. Thousands of supporters of Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan are converging on the capital, Islamabad, to demand his release from prison. Mr. Khan's wife, Bushra Bibi, who's leading one of the convoys, told supporters the march wouldn't end until he was free. Caroline Davies is in Islamabad and she joins us now. Caroline, what have you been hearing about this protest?
So I've been out in central Islamabad today to see exactly what's happening on the ground. And the city has been essentially locked down. There are shipping containers that are blocking large amounts of the roads. The internet is sporadic at best. And in fact, a large amount of the time just doesn't work at all if you're not on Wi-Fi. And even if you are on Wi-Fi connections at the moment, certain apps like Instagram and WhatsApp, people have been reporting difficulties and problems with them throughout the course of the day. Schools here have also been closed entirely for the day because of these levels of disruption. Now, I think one thing to kind of bear in mind is that this is not entirely new for Islamabad. People have started referring to the capital city as Containerstan because there are so many shipping containers that are sitting perched by the side of the road, ready for the authorities to pull them across and block the whole city up. And we saw a protest by PTI, which also had a similar reaction by the authorities, and subsequently the whole city was shut down near the beginning of October. So we've seen these sort of protests relatively frequently. But what we are waiting to see is whether this protest has a different sort of reaction or is different to the previous ones. There are certain seeds of things in this protest, as you suggested in the introduction, that could mean that things are different. Bushra Bibi, Imran Khan's wife, is leading one of the marches towards the capital, and she has been quite a strong force in encouraging people to keep going forward, keep the pressure up. We also know that because Imran Khan called for this protest from prison, has been in prison since August last year, that there is pressure too on the leadership of his party, of PTI, who are not in prison, to show their loyalty and commitment to the cause. So will that combined lead to a greater reaction or something more that we'll see in the course of this protest, we don't know. But the authorities have yet again come out quite strongly. We have seen huge sort of blockades up on the, in the motorways and the streets. So these are two pretty immovable forces now suddenly meeting each other on Islamabad's outskirts.
Kerry, just briefly, what's the response inside Islamabad? How are people coping?
Well, people are, a lot of people whose businesses rely on either people being able to physically get to them can't open. People who rely on internet services aren't able to really open to operate. So delivery drivers, things like that, that's incredibly difficult. I think that there is a level to which people are frustrated, but again, have seen this so repeatedly. I think many people are waiting to see whether or not they're going to just see another repeat of this in several weeks' time, or okay, if this is going to be a different sort of protest.
Okay, Caroline, thank you. Caroline Davies is in Islamabad for the BBC. I'm Celia Hatton with NewsHour, coming to you live from our studio in London. Well, Angela Merkel led Germany for 16 years and for much of that time was seen as the most powerful woman in the world. She held her position during the financial crisis, the migrant crisis and Russia's 2014 invasion of Ukraine. It's a legacy she's now having to defend in her new memoir, Freedom, and an interview with the BBC's Europe editor, Katja Adler. Katja, who joins me now. You spoke to Angela Merkel just as Germany's gearing up for an election and the former Chancellor's party is in trouble.
The former Chancellor's party is actually doing quite well. So they're the ones who expected to perform most strongly in the election. But because of the system in Germany, it's quite splintered. And so very likely they will have to form a coalition government. And that's the CDU party. It is a different party. The leader is very different to how she was at the time. In that way, it's extremely different. And I think, you know, she governed Germany for 16 years, as you say, and some Germans say that she put the whole country under a Sleeping Beauty sleep. If you remember the fairy tale, as she was put to sleep for 100 years. In this case, it was 16 years under Angela Merkel. But German voters did vote for her again and again over, you know, four successive times in government. But very soon after she left, Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine with a large scale invasion. And there's been a lot of a look back at her career since then, questioning, was she too soft on Russia, too slow to help Ukraine? Why did she harness Germany to cheap Russian energy? Look at what it did to that trade with China, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why she, after such a rosy time in government, if you like, where she had opinion polls pretty much to the end that other leaders would be really jealous of, now she really is having to defend that legacy.
You sat down with Angela Merkel and you asked her to reflect on some of her decisions, including her decision to block Ukraine's NATO membership in 2008. What did she tell you?
Well, I think if you think of the French singer Edith Piaf, Je ne regrette rien, I don't regret anything, that song would fit Angela Merkel's general demeanour. I think you put forward a lot of the criticisms made about her and she defends her decisions. In 2008, then US President Bush wanted to fast track Ukraine's membership to NATO. He believed that under the military alliance's umbrella, that would keep Ukraine safe. And she said no. She says she doesn't regret the decision and she wasn't alone in that decision. France supported her in it, for example. She said Ukraine wasn't ready. It was divided about its NATO membership. And also she felt that Vladimir Putin wouldn't stand idly by, she said, and just basically watch while Ukraine entered. And so she thinks that war would have started earlier and Ukraine would have been on the back foot.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from your interview with Angela Merkel.
We would have seen military conflict even earlier. It was completely clear to me that President Putin would not have stood idly by and watched Ukraine join NATO. Other European countries were also opposed. And back then, Ukraine as a country would certainly not have been as prepared as it was in February 2022.
While you were German Chancellor, you got to know Vladimir Putin very well. Is he a rational man? He's just changed his nuclear doctrine. Should the world be worried that he might use nuclear weapons?
Every effort must be made. And fortunately, China also made a statement some time ago that nuclear weapons should not be used. Russia's potential is frightening.
You say in your memoirs that it became very clear to you that the biggest priority for Vladimir Putin was power and reducing Western influence in Europe that had gained after the Cold War. But despite that, you allowed Germany to become energy dependent on Russia. How do you respond to those who criticize you and say that you put German business interests before European security?
I was motivated by two things. Firstly, Germany's economic interest. Secondly, I believe that despite all the difficulties, we should do everything we can to establish a relationship with Russia that would enable us to coexist peacefully. I did try to curb the attacks in Ukraine through the Minsk agreements. That worked to an extent for a few years, though not brilliantly.
President Obama, who was you were very close to at the time, he begged you not to build a second gas pipeline to Russia. It was built in 2014, after Vladimir Putin had already partially invaded Ukraine. Volodymyr Zelensky described that cheap gas from Russia as a geopolitical weapon of the Kremlin. He said it was dangerous for all of Europe. But you didn't listen to Ukraine. You didn't listen to President Obama. Do you regret that now?
No, I don't regret that. Of course we heard these warnings, and I did listen. We then reached an agreement with President Biden that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline could be put into operation, but only if energy was not used as a weapon. And I considered this agreement the right thing to do. The pipeline did not go into operation because the full-scale invasion of Ukraine made it obsolete.
Let's talk about migration politics. In 2015, you let over a million asylum seekers and other migrants into Germany. Do you accept the criticism of those who say that your migration politics at the time actually breathed life into the far right in Germany, but in the rest of Europe as well?
Well, there are other countries with strong right-wing parties that don't have any great issues with migration. So I can't declare myself responsible for the whole of Europe.
But Germany's AfD party was almost dead in 2015.
Yes, thanks to the large number of incoming refugees, the AfD has regained support. And that is why it is so important that we solve the problem of illegal migration. It was for these reasons that I concluded the agreement with Turkey. Back then, the number of Syrian refugees coming from Turkey fell by over 90%. It worked. So we must reduce illegal migration. That's the best answer to the AfD. But we're not yet where we need to be.
You were Chancellor of Germany when Donald Trump came to the White House for the first time. He was furious with Europe, particularly with Germany, about trade, about defense spending. How did you manage him?
Donald Trump is someone who doesn't believe in win-win situations, but instead always believes there must be one winner. And that makes the discussion more difficult than with others. It is always very important to have clearly formulated your own interests and not to be afraid. And when you do that, there is a certain mutual respect.
The BBC's Europe editor Katja Adler speaking to Angela Merkel.
Let's turn to South Korea and the port city of Busan, where delegates from 175 countries have converged to hammer out the final details on a global treaty to curb plastic pollution. Those pushing for a binding deal say the world is producing far more plastic than it has the ability to process. The United Nations estimates that about 20 million tons of it ends up in our seas and oceans annually. Microplastics have been found at the top of Mount Everest and even inside the bodies of fish. Opening the event, the chair of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee on Plastic Pollution, or the UNINC, Luis Valles-Vadvesco, said the issue must be addressed now.
We are here today because plastic pollution is not just an unsilent nuisance, but an urgent and insidious threat to ecosystems, economies, and human health. The magnitude of the crisis is evident and underscores the urgency of our mission.
But some countries with huge oil and petrochemical industries are challenging the terms of the treaty. Eric Lindberg is the World Wildlife Foundation's head of delegation to the talks. When I spoke to him earlier from Busan, he told me what's at stake.
If negotiators don't agree to a strong and binding treaty, they will be responsible for plastic pollution actually projected to triple by 2040. Plastic pollution is already having devastating impacts on ecosystems, nature, livelihoods, and also human health. And it is then exponentially growing. So it is essential that we get the treaty that regulates plastics across the entire life cycle of plastics in order to end it at a global level.
There are some in the petrochemical industry who say that really the treaty needs to focus on ending plastic waste instead of limiting production. Is that a good compromise?
It's impossible to end plastic pollution only by waste management. We need all kinds of measures. We need waste management. We need better product design. We need better systems for dealing with plastics and for reuse. And we need to really ban the plastic products and types of plastics and chemicals in plastics that are harmful and that we absolutely don't need. That's the only way that we're going to be able to deal with the problem and also do it in a cost-effective way. The amount of money you would have to invest in waste management infrastructure in order to deal with just exponentially growing plastic production is unbelievable. It's unfinanceable. It's basically not possible for us to handle those kind of amounts of waste. We're already not handling plastic waste that we're generating today.
Eric, you're at the talks right now being held in South Korea. What's happening at the talks? Which countries are possibly standing in the way of finalizing a global treaty?
Today, there was an attempt by Saudi Arabia, Russia, and Iran to refuse the chair's basis for negotiations for moving forward. However, ultimately, all countries did agree to move ahead with this, and those concerns were actually pulled back by those countries. I think they are few, they're isolated. They also don't have the science and the facts on their side. And of course, being, I think, also a bit desperate, feeling that they are kind of losing. There is such an overwhelming majority that is ready to push for this.
How optimistic are you that these talks will end with quite a strong and binding treaty?
On the one hand, countries, in a way, don't really have a choice. There's so much at stake. There is such a big push from the general public, from academia, and from also a large part of industry involved in plastic use, that I think countries have to deliver a strong and binding treaty. So I'm quite hopeful, because there is so many countries wanting this, but at the same time, it will be a politically tough battle, and it will ultimately be a political choice. Is the progressive majority ready to move ahead, even if some countries will protest at the end? If so, this will be a huge success.
That was Eric Lindberg, the WWF's head of delegation to the talks in South Korea. And you can find more information on the lead up to this plastic pollution negotiation treaty on the BBC website. This is NewsHour, coming to you on the BBC World Service. So, here's a question. If you're at the movie theatre really enjoying a musical on the big screen, is it ever okay to break into song? That's the debate that's being had in cinemas around the world as audiences jostle to see the highly promoted musical Wicked. And for some, it's a chance to sing along to one of the movie's best-known tunes, Defying Gravity. Others don't want to hear anyone but the movie stars singing at full volume. Well, we brought together two people on opposite sides to share their opinions. Sarah Cook is a Wicked superfan and author, and Sasha Mooney is the owner of Futurist Cinema in Kidderminster here in the UK.
I started by asking Sarah what she thinks of the audience singing along.
I'm on the no singing, absolutely no singing, unless you're in a specific sing-along event.
Okay, we're going to have to pick that apart. And Sasha, what's your view on this? I mean, you own a theatre, don't you?
Yeah, I own a small independent cinema. And if it's not harming anybody, let them sing.
Okay, so we've got both sides. We've heard from some, for example, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, big Hollywood actor. Now, he says people pay good money for tickets, so they should be able to belt it out in the theatre if they want to. Sarah, why do you disagree with this idea?
I think it's a matter of courtesy, really. For a start, if I'm paying money for something, I want to see the professionals sing. I don't want to hear anyone else who thinks they can sing, sing it badly or poorly. And the other thing is that some people may not know the show entirely. So they might be coming into Wicked completely new, not knowing any of the songs, and then have it ruined by someone who's singing it off key behind them or like in front of them.
So you're a fan of Wicked. Have you seen it in the theatre so far? Has your viewing experience been ruined by any off-note singers?
Surprisingly, I've seen it twice and my experience has not been ruined. People have been relatively quiet. A lot of passionate mouthing along, but no bad singers so far.
And Sasha, what's been the experience so far with your theatre? Have you had to deal with anybody, you know, ticket holders who are furious with others?
No, not at all. I don't know whether they have been singing along. I'd be very surprised if they at least haven't been humming. And no, we've not had a single complaint at all. Everybody's come out. We've had one or two that have come out before the hour is up, but that generally happens. If somebody goes to a film and they're not ready for them, they'll come out before the hour is up, and you know that. But other than that, no, we've not had a single complaint. We are going to put on some separate screenings which are for sing-alongs. So where the idea is, you know, have a bottle of Prosecco and sing your little heart out. I do agree it's totally etiquette for it, but if somebody's singing in the cinema and it's not really harming others around them, then no, I would just say let them do it.
Does this all come down to etiquette, really?
Yeah.
Sarah, is singing along in enjoyment really that different from somebody who has a conversation next to you in the cinema?
I hate people having conversations next to me in the cinema. So yeah, for me, it's the same level. I think if you're going in, you're going in to shut out from the world, to be quiet and immerse yourself in the story. So be quiet as possible. Leave your phones in your bags and just enjoy what's on the screen.
I was going to say, there's certain element there I would totally agree. I think the one is on a slightly different level. The phones and the talking and all the rest of it is... that is definitely an etiquette, and there should be far less. I think the singing is part of the euphoria of being in a crowd, watching that film. It's an atmosphere and euphoria. And that's ultimately some ways why we go to the theatre, why we go to the cinema, is to be part of that group euphoria of enjoyment at that moment. So I think the singing is slightly different. It's not the same as taking your phone out or talking to somebody. You're caught up in a moment.
Is this debate a new one, or are there past films? I'm thinking of things like Mamma Mia or Les Miserables that also have well-known scores. Have we seen this before, Sasha?
Oh, absolutely. I remember the first time I went and watched Commitments. I went back a second time to watch it so I could hum along to the film. I loved it. There was no soundtrack, but I loved the music. It was like, oh, right, I'll go back and watch it again so I can hum along. I think I think it'll sort of always be there. And it also is dependent upon, because as they say, horses for courses, it's dependent on different films. I will never go and watch Wicked. It's not my cup of tea. But anybody wants to go and watch it and see sing with it all. But I'll be there one of the first at the Rocky Horror.
And Sarah, what do you think? I mean, are we going to have singing and non-singing showings of films in the future?
But they do that, and that's why I think that if you want to go, like they're already planning sing-along events. There were sing-alongs for Matilda. Rocky Horror is a sing-along in its nature. You go, that's part of the experience. I've been to sing-along Great Showman, sing-along Frozen, and I think if you want to sing along, go to those specific ones and belt your heart, because that's what people are paying to go do. If it's not a sing-along, keep your mouth shut.
Okay. Anybody else with any other thoughts? Anything that we haven't asked about that either one of you want to add in?
No, I would just think, you know, if it's not disturbing someone else, live and let live. If it is disturbing to someone else, of course, then we can either look to ask them to keep quiet or move them to a different part of the cinema. Cinemas are quite big, generally. You can fit a few people in them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, live and let live.
Some strong opinions there. Well, Sasha Mooney is the owner of Futurist Cinema in Kidderminster here in the UK, and Sarah Cook, a Wicked superfan and author, in that discussion on that all-important issue.